The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we're reading from the edition dated December 23rd, 2011, our special holiday reading of The Week magazine. Now we'll read from the main stories section, the battle over the payroll tax cut. What happened? The White House and congressional Republicans capped one of the most contentious years in American political history this week with another showdown over a proposal to extend this year's payroll tax cut for 160 million workers and employers. House Republicans passed a bill that gave Obama and the Democrats the tax cuts they wanted, but tied them to a host of unrelated provisions, including one requiring President Obama to decide on the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline from Canada to the Gulf Coast within 60 days. The White House had previously said it would delay that decision until 2013. Obama threatened to veto the bill, but it had no chance of passing the Democratic-controlled Senate with the provisions intact. Senate Democrats were insisting on restoring a provision to pay for the tax cut by imposing a 1.9% surcharge on incomes over $1 million. As the week went to press last week, the two sides were once again at an impasse, raising the possibility of a government shutdown. The latest congressional battle over taxes came as President Obama sought to frame the 2012 elections as a choice between his advocacy for the middle class and Republican insistence on protecting the interests of the wealthy. "We are at a crossroads," he said during an interview on 60 Minutes this week. "Do we want a society in which we have a tax code where everybody's paying their fair share, or an economy in which you're on your own and big corporations can write their own rules?" Republican presidential candidate Newt Gingrich accused the president of advocating class warfare and bureaucratic socialism. Now here's what the editorial said. "So this is how 2011 ends," said the Los Angeles Times, "with Congress once again resorting to the bureaucratic equivalent of death threats. Earlier this year, Republicans threatened to shut down the government unless Democrats agreed to cut spending. Now Democrats are doing the same thing over the wrong-headed provisions in the payroll tax cut bill. But this sort of hostage-taking is repulsive, no matter who's doing it. Congress must agree on a long-term plan to promote growth and reduce the deficit in 2012, or face another year of stumbling from impasse to impasse." But it was Obama who started this payroll tax fight, said the Wall Street Journal, by insisting it be paid for with a millionaire's tax. This was just a transparent ruse to get to put Republicans on the class warfare spot and boost the president's reelection campaign. Republicans sensibly want to offset the $250 billion cost of the payroll tax cut with spending cuts and job-creating initiatives like the Keystone XL pipeline. Sadly for the nation, Obama and his party prefer to focus on income redistribution and politics. Now here's what the columnist said. "Class warfare is all Obama has left," said Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post. "Three out of four Americans now believe that the country is on the wrong track. The country is $15 trillion in debt, and Obama's signature achievements, the failed $860 billion stimulus, Obamacare, are more likely to be the stuff of Republican ads than of Democratic ones. So, of course, the president is going to run on the crude populism of higher taxes for the rich." There's nothing crude about addressing the nation's rising inequality, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. In recent months, the Occupy Wall Street protests focused the nation on such valid issues as bankers' pay, tax evasion by rich people, and corporate lobbying. That's why Obama is trying to force House Republicans into revealing moments like the feud over the millionaire surcharge, said Steve Kornacki in Salon.com. Portraying the GOP as champions of the rich is the best way to rally the 99% against them. But most independent voters don't care about how much the rich make, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. They're more concerned about how badly the middle class is doing. What Obama has failed to do so far is convince moderates that unequal income is hurting economic growth, or lay out any real plan to revive the middle class. Luckily, Obama still has almost a year to fill in the blanks. Now, from the main stories section, the next article is entitled, Iraq Without U.S. Troops. President Obama marked the end of the Iraq War by meeting Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki this week at the White House, where the two pledged that their countries would remain close allies after the last U.S. troops withdraw at the end of the year. Thanks to America's sacrifice in blood and treasure, the president said, we have now achieved an Iraq that is self-governing, that is inclusive, and that has enormous potential. Obama said the U.S. would supply military hardware and training to Iraq for years to come, but the meeting failed to soothe the many tensions between the two countries. Maliki refused, for instance, to support Obama's call for Syria's brutal leader Bashar al-Assad to step down, saying, I do not have the right to ask a president to abdicate. Obama has oversold the Maliki regime, said the Washington Post in an editorial. Rather than being inclusive, the Shiite prime minister has been concentrating power in his own hands and cruelly repressing minority Sunnis. When U.S. troops depart this month, the ethnic tensions fomented by Maliki could explode in a repeat of the sectarian bloodletting that ravaged the country between 2004 and 2007. As the U.S. backs away, Iran will fill any vacuum with its own influence, said Scott Peterson in CSMonitor.com. Maliki's refusal to get tough on Syria, a longtime Iranian ally, suggests he's already in league with the mullahs next door. He's also backing Tehran's attempt to install a hardline Iranian cleric who is very close to Iran's absolute ruler Ayatollah Ali Khamenei in Iraq's holiest city, Najaf. But Iraqis won't easily surrender their newfound sovereignty, said Robert Dreyfus in The Nation. The country's citizens are fed up with being dominated by the U.S. Maliki might try to build an authoritarian, Iran-friendly regime, but most Iraqis don't want their neighbor telling them what to do either. With luck, Iraqi nationalism will reassert itself, and the country will finally decide its own future. The next item from the main story section, Russians take to the streets. Tens of thousands of Russians last week joined in the biggest protest rally since Vladimir Putin first became president 12 years ago to decry alleged fraud in the recent parliamentary elections. Many shouted, Putin is a thief, while others chanted, we are the 143%, a reference to the obviously fraudulent official vote tally in the Rostov district. Hundreds of people across the country were arrested at protests, which Putin blamed the U.S. for instigating. In an unprecedented concession to public opinion, the ruling United Russia Party's top official, Boris Gryzlov, resigned this past week as the state Duma speaker. Still, officials flatly rejected opposition calls for new elections and announced that the new Duma would be seated next week. Even Russia's docile press is turning on Putin, said Michael Schwartz in the New York Times. For years, newspapers have been allowed to criticize the Kremlin as long as they didn't attack Putin directly. This week, though, Kommersant Vlast, a printed photo of a ballot on which someone had scribbled, Putin is a D ... The sarcastic caption read, "A correctly marked ballot that was ruled invalid." The editor was promptly fired, but the issue was already on the newsstands. "All very bracing, but it won't change much," said Robert Saunders in Newsday. "Putin still controls all the levers of power. Now he realizes that he has violated the social contract with Russia's middle class, so he will appease them with the appearance of a genuine political contest for next March's presidential elections. Cue the pseudo-candidacy of Mikhail Prokhorov, the billionaire metals tycoon who announced this past week that he would run against Putin. He will lend the election an air of legitimacy, but make no mistake, Putin's victory next March is still just as assured as it was a few weeks ago." "So what?" asked Niall Ferguson in the DailyBeast.com. "It's a shame for Russians, of course, who have no hope of democracy and whose public life remains horribly and perhaps incurably deformed by 70 years of communist rule. But with its dwindling population and low GDP, Russia is no longer a global player. These days, it looks increasingly like Nigeria with snow, just another messed up petro-kleptocracy." And now from The Week magazine, we'll turn to the controversy of the week, Gingrich, a question of temperament. "Is Newt Gingrich nuts?" said Jacob Weisberg in Slate.com. "In the rough-and-tumble world of U.S. politics, accusing one's opponents of having crazy ideas is a common practice. But in the case of Gingrich, now the front-runner for the GOP presidential nomination, many prominent Republicans are openly questioning whether he's mentally fit to be the leader of the free world. Throughout his career in public life, Gingrich has displayed an alarming grandiosity and megalomania, describing himself as a definer of civilization and a transformational figure who helped defeat communism and is fated to play a critical role in history, like Churchill. The Republican establishment is in full unconcealed panic at Gingrich's sudden ascent in the polls, said Andrew Sullivan in the DailyBeast.com, describing him as narcissistic, dangerous, and not stable. TV talk show host Joe Scarborough, a former Republican congressman who served under Gingrich in the House, said he's a terrible person who alienated most of his colleagues and would do the same to independent voters, thus ensuring Barack Obama's reelection. Gingrich may have changed, said Paul Gigo in WallStreetJournal.com. Those advising him during the current near-miraculous political comeback say he's mellowed with age and since his conversion to Catholicism, and that he has a new calm about him. In last weekend's Iowa debate, certainly the candidate who took the stage was a model of restraint and self-discipline, enduring attacks from all sides with good humor and maturity. If this new cool hand Newt remains on display, conservatives may well make him their nominee. What really troubles the Beltway Republican establishment, said Christian Whiten in FoxNews.com, is not Newt's supposed lack of stability, but his independence. As President Gingrich would turn Washington upside down, hence the current effort to smear him as a madman. Don't believe the myth of the new Newt, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Since he began running for president, the older and supposedly wiser Gingrich, 68, has denounced Representative Paul Ryan's Medicare reform proposal as right-wing social engineering, then pretended he didn't mean it, blasted Obama for not intervening in Libya, and then for intervening, and called for poor children to be hired as janitors in schools. Beware, the old Newt lurks. Republican voters looking for a candidate to keep the spotlight on President Obama's dismal record next year don't want a nominee who will make the election a referendum on his own sanity. Look, there's only one viable conservative left in the race, said Jed Babin in the American Spectator, and it's Newt. Conservatives like the fact that Gingrich speaks his mind without testing his views on a focus group. And what Gingrich has been saying about the lack of a worth ethic among the poor or the illegitimacy of the Palestinians is what a lot of people are thinking. Gingrich may indeed have become more strategy, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal, and that's what terrifies the GOP establishment the most. What they fear is that he will show just enough discipline over the next few months, just enough focus to win the nomination, and that then, in the glare of the general election campaign, the old Newt will ruin the GOP's golden opportunity to beat Obama. That unpredictability is what makes Gingrich so fascinating. He is a human hand grenade who walks around with his hand on the pen, saying, "Watch this." And you're listening to our reading of the Week magazine for December 23rd, 2011. Thanks for joining me today. Now we'll turn to the very popular column entitled Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. It was a good week for sanity after all but two Republican presidential candidates declined to participate in a debate to be moderated by Donald Trump. The billionaire businessman gave up on hosting a debate, but warned the GOP he might run as an independent. It was a good week for scrimping after it was announced that new austerity measures would freeze the British royal family's government stipend, limiting Queen Elizabeth and the royals to $50 million a year. And it was a good week for joyrides after three people left a bar in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, mounted horses and rode them into a Starbucks and a Safeway to get some munchies. I had a great ride right up until the very end, said Michael Miller, whose night ended when police tasered and arrested him. And it was a bad week for trust in government after a Gallup poll found that 64% of Americans rate the honesty and ethical standards of members of Congress as low or very low, their worst rating on record. In fact, Congress now rates below telemarketers. It was a bad week for licking the bowl after a new study found that a 2009 E. coli outbreak that sickened at least 80 people in 30 states was caused by eating raw cookie dough. Some people who buy cookie dough, researchers noted, had no plans to actually bake cookies. And it was a bad week for practicing what you preach after Australian Communications Minister Stephen Conroy, who is in charge of broadcasting standards, said the F word on live television. He quickly added, "Excuse me." Now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the People section of the publication. Our first item is entitled Attenborough's Trials. Sir David Attenborough has endured some pretty harsh conditions for the sake of his art, said Jan Moir in the London Daily Mail. During his 60-year career, the naturalist and broadcaster has survived on grubs in the jungle, laying for hours on his stomach in 120-degree desert heat in order to film scorpions, and braved punishing cold in the Arctic and the Antarctic for the series Frozen Planet. During the filming of that TV series, the 85-year-old was caught on an Antarctic plateau when a sudden blizzard blew up, battering his tent. "I was screaming into the microphone to make myself heard," he says. But Attenborough's worst trial took place in a remote Indian village many years ago when the locals threw a party for his departing crew. The old women take guava fruit and sort of mumble it between their teeth and then spit it into an old canoe, he explains. They leave it for 4 or 5 days when it starts to bubble and smell unappealing, shall we put it that way? The resulting concoction was served up in a hollowed-out gourd. I remember thinking, I am not going to be able to do this twice, so I'd better get it down properly the first time. So I did, and managed to summon a smile afterward, and someone cried, "He likes it. Give him another." Next item from the People section, Cain's Other Woman. Ginger White feels used, said Leslie Bennett in the DailyBeast.com. The Atlanta single mother recently alleged that she had had a 13-year affair with Herman Cain, a revelation that derailed his floundering campaign for the Republican presidential nomination. When White, who is 46, first met Cain in the late 1990s, she was impressed by his confidence. "I was amazed at how a person could just come up to you at a cocktail party, and an hour and a half later, he wanted me to follow him to his hotel to plan our first trip to Palm Springs," she says. For her, the relationship provided not only romantic getaways, but financial support. She always knew it was headed nowhere. "Herman helped me out because it meant I could be there if he ever needed another fling. One time we were having sex and I was looking up at the ceiling thinking, what am I going to buy at the grocery store tomorrow?" Their relationship ended this spring when Cain, who has been married for 43 years, told White that he was running for president. "I said, I guess we won't be friends anymore." He said, "No, I don't think so." It confirmed what I already felt. It wasn't a love affair. It wasn't even a friendship, really. And the next item, Johansson's Naked Truth. Scarlett Johansson isn't easily embarrassed, said Peter Biskind in Vanity Fair. This spring, a hacker stole a set of nude photos from the 27-year-old actress's cell phone and posted the sexy self-portraits online. "Many women would be mortified, but Johansson is unashamed. The photos were sent to my husband," Johansson explains, referring to her ex, the actor Ryan Reynolds. "There's nothing wrong with that. It's not like I was shooting a porno, although there's nothing wrong with that either. She's proud of how she looks in the shots, which showed her lounging on a bed and posing in front of a mirror. I know my best angle," she says, smiling. "This isn't the first time Johansson has had her private life exposed. Last year, her divorce from Reynolds made her a staple of the tabloid press. I had a very public separation. It felt very uncomfortable." Johansson blames the breakup on her own naivete. I was not fully aware of the peaks and the valleys. I wasn't prepared to hunker down and do the work. But she doesn't regret the 2-year marriage. It seemed like a very romantic thing to do, and it was. It was the best thing I ever did. Now, as a continuation of the People's section this week, we're going to turn to the Obituary section from the Week magazine. This item is entitled, "The Musician Dubbed the Duke of Uke." Bill Tapia made fretboard acrobatics famous decades before Jimi Hendrix was born. As a child musician, the ukulele player's trademark stunt was to play "The Stars and Stripes Forever" on the tiny instrument while holding it behind his neck. It was a trick that he continued performing well beyond his 100th birthday. Tapia was born in Honolulu and began playing the ukulele at the age of 7, said the Honolulu Star Advertiser. He lived down the street from the Portuguese ukulele maker Manuel Nunes and bought his first instrument from him for 75 cents. "He wanted $1.50, Tapia would later recall, "but it was all the money I had." Within 3 years, he was playing shows for World War I soldiers in theaters in Waikiki. His unique arrangement of "The Stars and Stripes Forever" became a standard tune for generations of Hawaiian musicians. For years, he would introduce it with the line, "Here's a song I performed during World War I." Tapia began playing jazz guitar during the 1920s, said the Fretboard Journal, but the ukulele was always his instrument of choice. He moved to Hollywood, where he regaled guests in bars and clubs with Hawaiian love songs and jazz classics. Despite the Depression, Tapia was finding more success than ever, earning around $96 a week at a time when a 4-course meal on Hollywood Boulevard cost 35 cents. World War II broke out, and Tapia did U.S. shows for troops, But post-war Hollywood wasn't the same, and the ukulele wasn't in demand much. Tapia returned to guitar playing, and the world moved on. It wasn't until a half century later that Tapia picked up a ukulele again, said the New York Times, at a guitar store in California. In the early 2000s, the ukulele was enjoying a resurgence of popularity, and Tapia was soon embraced by a new generation. He recorded his first album, Tropical Swing, at the age of 96, and would go on to record two more LPs. Tapia played regular concerts right up until his final days, as he once predicted he would. "I was brought up with the ukulele," he said in 2007. "I guess I'll end with the ukulele." Bill Tapia, born in 1908, died in 2011 at the age of 103. And the next item, the hardest working actor in Hollywood. To millions of TV viewers, Harry Morgan will always be remembered as Colonel Sherman T. Potter, commander of the 4077th Mobile Army Surgical Hospital Unit in Korea. With a wry smile and a dry wit, Morgan played Potter from 1975 to 1983 when MASH went off the air. But he hadn't been the first choice to head the show's field hospital. When MASH debuted in 1972, McLean Stevenson was cast as camp commander, Lieutenant Colonel Henry Blake. Morgan appeared as a crazed general in an episode in 1974 and so impressed producers that they hired him when Stevenson unexpectedly quit the next year. "He was always thankful for the opportunity. I think it's the best part I ever had," Morgan said in 2004. Morgan was born Harry Bratsberg in 1915 in Detroit, where his Norwegian father worked in the auto industry. He left high school with dreams of becoming a lawyer, but after taking debating classes at the University of Chicago, he changed his mind and plunged into the theater, said Variety. Assuming the name Morgan, which he found more mellifluous than Bratsberg, he joined a repertory company in Westport, Connecticut. One early part cast him opposite a young Henry Fonda in a stage production of The Virginian, said the London Telegraph. Morgan made his way to California in 1942 and was spotted by a talent scout. He went on to play in more than 100 films and showed remarkable versatility, appearing as a drifter caught up in a lynching in 1943's The Oxbow Incident, a menacing bodyguard in 1948's The Big Clock, and a small-town Tennessee judge in 1960's Inherit the Wind. His television credits were just as prodigious, including leading roles in detective drama Dragnet and the comedies December Bride and Pete and Gladys. He once estimated that in one show or another, he was seen in prime time for 35 straight years, said the New York Times. Despite his fame, Morgan never sat as a guest on a talk show. Appearing on a talk show to focus on himself because he was Harry Morgan was not nearly as natural as appearing in a role, said his son Charles. Harry Morgan, born in 1915, died in 2011, just this past week. And now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the very popular column entitled The Briefing. And this week, the subject of The Briefing is a mandate for controversy. President Obama's health care bill requires that every American have health insurance. Is that constitutional? Who first proposed making health insurance compulsory? The Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank in the late 1980s when Democrats were pushing to require employers to provide health insurance. The foundation started thinking about ways to achieve universal coverage without placing a heavy burden on business. Its experts soon encountered the free rider problem. In a system where insurers are barred from refusing applicants with pre-existing conditions, many people, especially the young and healthy, would only buy a policy when illness struck. But if only sick people bought coverage, insurers would pay out more in doctor's bills than they received in premiums and quickly go bust. To overcome this death spiral, the Heritage Foundation suggested that every American be required to buy health insurance, a requirement known as the individual mandate. Which politicians took up that idea? Well, many Republicans did in the early 1990s after President Clinton introduced a plan that would have forced companies to cover employees. I am for people, individuals, exactly like automobile insurance, having health insurance and being required to have health insurance, said Newt Gingrich, and then the House Minority Whip in 1993. When the Clinton plan collapsed in 1994, talk of the individual mandate died with it. But a decade later, Mitt Romney, then the governor of Massachusetts, resurrected the concept for his state health care plan, which requires residents to buy health insurance or pay up to $1,212 in annual penalties. It's a Republican way of reforming the market, Romney said, when the law debuted in 2006. To have people show up in a hospital when they get sick and expect someone else to pay, that's a Democratic approach. So why did Obama adopt a Republican proposal? At first, he didn't want to. During his 2008 campaign for the Democratic nomination, Obama ran a TV ad criticizing rival candidate Hillary Clinton's support for a mandate, saying she would force everyone to buy insurance even if you can't afford it. But after President Obama and the Democratic Congress began to construct his health care plan, advisors warned that free riders would undermine the objectives of extending insurance coverage to anyone who wanted it. For health reform to work, young, healthy people had to be pushed into the pool to spread cost and risk. So the president allowed his 2010 Affordable Care Act to incorporate a provision that by 2014, all Americans must have health coverage or face a tax penalty. Conservatives decried that directive as a gross infringement of individual liberty, and their anger helped fuel the rise of the Tea Party. 26 states and the National Federation of Independent Business are now challenging the mandate's constitutionality at the Supreme Court, which will make a final judgment by June. How has Obama responded? His administration argues that the mandate is authorized by the Constitution's Commerce Clause, which allows the federal government to regulate interstate economic activity. Several conservative judges agree. In a November appeals court decision that upheld the mandate, Judge Lawrence Silberman, a Reagan appointee, declared that Congress must be free to forge national solutions to national problems. And this summer, Judge Jeffrey Sutton, a George Bush appointee to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, concluded that the individual mandate is a legally sound way to prevent taxpayers and hospitals from having to pick up the cost of treating the uninsured. Not every intrusive law is an unconstitutionally intrusive law, he wrote. Haven't other judges disagreed? Yes, in August, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals declared that it could find no precedent for ordering Americans to buy health insurance, even in the face of a Great Depression, a world war, a Cold War, recessions, oil shocks, inflation, and unemployment, the majority wrote. Congress never sought to require the purchase of wheat or war bonds, force a higher savings rate, or greater consumption of American goods. Other federal judges and critics of Obamacare warn that the mandate sets a dangerous precedent that the government could use to make citizens purchase whatever it deems good for them or for the economy. Congress could require every American to buy a new Chevy Impala every year, said a 2009 Heritage Foundation report. What happens if the individual mandate is voided? It depends. If the Supreme Court decides that the Affordable Care Act can't function without the individual mandate, it could strike down the entire law. But it might declare the mandate severable and remove that particular part of the law while letting the rest of it limp along, with far fewer uninsured people covered and less ability to rein in costs. Some experts have proposed that instead of the uninsured being required to buy insurance, they could be nudged into the healthcare system by giving them a window of time during which they could buy insurance relatively inexpensively. Once that window closed, the cost would rise sharply. The problem with any alternative to the individual mandate, said Paul Ginsberg, president of the Center for Studying Health System Change, is that it would have to be approved by the bitterly divided Congress. You can't expect that in these times, he said. People don't work on these compromises too readily anymore. And the carve-out section here from this particular briefing article is entitled How the Supreme Court Could Punt. Next year's Supreme Court hearing has been billed as Judgment Day for Obama's Affordable Care Act, but it might end with no judgment at all. Before the justices rule on the individual mandate's constitutionality, they will first have to decide whether the 1867 Anti-Injunction Act bars the claimant's challenge. That law prevents citizens from challenging the legality of a tax before it goes into effect. If the court finds that the penalty for defying the Affordable Care Act's mandate is a tax, they could push a legal challenge back to 2015 when the first fines will be levied. And that, said Simon Lazarus, an expert at the National Senior Citizens Law Center, might be a good solution for a court that doesn't really care to be public issue number one in an election year. Now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the best columns in the United States this week, and we may also read from the best columns in Europe as well as an addition for this week's reading. The first item is entitled The Peril of Domestic Drones by Glenn Greenwald in Salon.com. Drone warfare is now coming to your own backyard, said Glenn Greenwald. Local police have begun using unmanned predator drones like those used in Afghanistan and Pakistan to conduct surveillance of criminal suspects right here in the United States. This chilling step toward a surveillance state without the public's knowledge or consent was revealed last week by the Los Angeles Times, which detailed the use of two predators to spy on and apprehend three North Dakota farmers. The farmers, who belong to a group that claims the federal government has no authority, had refused to hand over six cows that wandered onto their land. Police called in the drones, whose high-resolution cameras pinpointed the men's location and determined that they were unarmed. It's no accident that some of the first Americans to be targeted by drones were political dissidents. Will dangerous Tea Partiers or Occupy Wall Street protesters be next? Drones have an unprecedented ability to hover silently overhead for hours and are the ultimate tool for invasive, sustained surveillance and control. You'd have to be pathologically naive not to see the potential for abuse. The next column is entitled Romney's $10,000 Mistake by Garance Franca Ruta in TheAtlantic.com. Mitt Romney just made his first big campaign error, said Garance Franca Ruta. At the Republican presidential debate in Des Moines last weekend, the former Massachusetts governor got flustered when rival Rick Perry taunted him over Romney Care's requirement that citizens buy health insurance. With an irritated grin, Romney offered to bet Perry $10,000 that he hadn't recommended that other states adopt Massachusetts individual mandate. Big mistake. Here was a candidate who grew up wealthy and amassed his own $250 million fortune, casually offering to bet thousands of dollars. Who has $10,000 to bet with these days, or any other? Certainly not Iowans, whose average income is $38,000. Romney's rivals quickly pounced on his wager as proof that he's out of touch. Newt Gingrich's campaign manager joked that Romney carries $10,000 in his pocket, while Democrats gleefully informed reporters that $10,000 could buy an average American family 3 years of groceries. Romney's gaffe probably isn't fatal, but now that he's lost his front-runner status to Newt Gingrich, he also seems to be losing his cool. The next column is entitled, How to Save the U.S. Postal Service by Jeff Jacoby in the Boston Globe. Email isn't killing the U.S. Postal Service, said Jeff Jacoby. Inefficiency is. The Postal Service has announced that in order to make up for the drop in mail volume and revenue caused by the Internet, it's shutting about half of its mail processing centers and ending next-day delivery. But while email might have made business tougher, it can't be blamed for most of the USPS's woes. After all, its private rivals UPS and FedEx, are flourishing. Why? Because they have something the post office lacks: competitors. Unlike the post office, which has a monopoly on letter delivery, FedEx and UPS have had to compete for customers by boosting quality and holding prices down. Today, labor accounts for just 32% of FedEx's budget, compared with 82% at the U.S. Postal Service. If we really want to halt the post office's miserable decline, we need to throw open mail delivery to the private sector. And only when the Postal Service is accountable, only when its customers are free to take their business elsewhere, will the endless round of excuses and losses and service reductions finally come to an end. Now, from the Week magazine, let's turn to a couple of the international columns this week. The first one is entitled, Epidemic of Rhino Robberies by Stefan Ulrich in Süddeutsche Zeitung. Forget gold, said Stefan Ulrich. Today's sophisticated thieves are trafficking in rhinoceros horns, which can fetch up to $300,000 each. The horns are ground down and sold to the Asian market, where rhino horn powder is believed to cure everything from migraines to cancer, but is most often marketed to treat male impotence. This year alone, robbers have stolen rhinoceros horns from museums, antique stores, and even private collections in at least 8 European countries. Some of the holdups are like something right out of a Hollywood heist movie. Just last week in France, where most of the robberies have occurred, bandits burst into a Paris nature museum, sprayed tear gas at the guards, grabbed a white rhino horn out of a display, and sped off in a getaway car. Now that European museums have been picked nearly clean, zookeepers fear that the gang will start targeting their animals, killing them for their horns. Perhaps they should fight back by telling Asian customers the truth. Rhino horn is made of keratin, just like human hair and fingernails. If you're eating rhino powder for your libido, you do just as well to bite your nails. And the next column from Europe is from France, The Man Sarkozy Pushed Aside by Sophie Pilgrim from France24.com. President Nicolas Sarkozy's archenemy is back and baying for his blood, his arch enemy, I should say, said Sophie Pilgrim. Dominique de Villepin has been acquitted of all charges of trying to smear Sarkozy, charges Villepin says were trumped up, and has just announced that he will run for president. The two men developed their bitter rivalry when they were both cabinet ministers under Jacques Chirac. Back then, Villepin seemed the natural choice to succeed as president, tan, suave, articulate, and hovering almost a foot above Sarkozy in height. Villepin would beat the current president hands down in a beauty pageant. And unlike Sarkozy's cringe-inducing speeches, Villepin's addresses are a joy to listen to. When, as foreign minister in 2003, he took the lectern at the UN to argue against the Iraq war, the Security Council gave him a rare standing ovation. Yet Villepin quickly disappeared from the political scene, brought down by a string of corruption scandals he claims were made up by Sarkozy's entourage. Does he have a chance now? The day after his announcement, he was polling at just 1%. But that could change. Sarkozy, at this point, is largely despised. Villepin is charming, and the French admire him. And another article from the European continent. This one from the UK, actually. It's isolated within Europe. Is the United Kingdom isolated within Europe? Prime Minister David Cameron has proved he is no pushover, said the London Times in an editorial. He has out-Thatchered Margaret Thatcher by becoming the first British leader to veto a European Union treaty. The French and the Germans last week came up with a plan to save the imperiled euro by changing the EU treaty to provide for oversight of national budgets for all members, including those like Britain that do not use the euro currency. Cameron threatened to veto the change unless it included a clause exempting Britain's financial sector from EU regulations. So now the rest of the EU is pressing ahead with a new pact. The French and the Germans, as well as the pro-Europe camp here at home, view Britain's decision to opt out as a betrayal. But in fact, the Prime Minister has delighted most of his countrymen by preserving British sovereignty. Don't think for a moment that Cameron's position comes from strength, said Peter Mandelson in The Guardian. Even Thatcher operated under the principle that we should never vacate a table at which a decision was being taken that affected British interests. Cameron has done just that, not because he chose to, but because he lacks the authority to stand up to the anti-Europe camp in his party. Now Britain will be left out of whatever new body arises to govern Europe's fiscal health. We have lost influence and gained nothing, not even the exemption from regulation that Cameron was insisting on. And that exemption was not even worth fighting for, said John Litchfield in The Independent. Cameron wanted Britain to become a kind of Cayman Islands within the European Union, enjoying the benefits of being part of a European single market for financial services, but not subject to EU oversight or regulation. No wonder the other leaders couldn't accept that. The rest of Europe may be saddened at Britain's behavior, but it shouldn't be surprised, said Paris Le Monde. The British do not believe in the idea of Europe. They never have. They have always been interested in just one thing, the single market. The rest of the European project of closer integration has always drawn British indifference, if not outright hostility. There should be no lamenting what happened last week in Brussels. The British have always been an island, separate from Europe. Now they are more insular than ever. Those poor continentals, said Boris Johnson in the London Telegraph, they are understandably put out at being proved so very wrong about the euro. For years, Britain wisely resisted the lure of the common currency, warning that monetary union wouldn't work without an anti-democratic political union. Now here we are in a euro crisis, and the Europeans are scrambling to create a sort of supranational and fiscal union, let's call it snafu, whose leaders are unaccountable to any electorate and whose rules aren't likely to be heeded any more than the old EU treaties were. Britain is much better off keeping its distance from a project so intellectually, morally, and democratically bankrupt. Now let's turn to the talking point section from The Week magazine for this week, and our first article is entitled Palestinians, an Invented People? Finally, a major American politician has spoken the truth about the Palestinians, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Republican presidential candidate Newt Gingrich said last week that the Palestinians are an invented people and questioned their right to nationhood. His comments triggered an international furor, but Gingrich is right. As he explained, there was no Palestinian Arab state or political entity under the Ottoman Empire or any previous ruler. Even 50 years ago, the people now known as Palestinians didn't regard themselves as distinct from other Arabs. It was only after the 1967 war, when Israel seized the West Bank and Gaza, that the absence of a Palestinian state was deemed intolerable. Even the Palestinians have admitted this, said Aaron Goldstein in the American Spectator. A top Palestinian Liberation Organization official said in 1977 that Palestinians are no different from other Arabs and that the creation of a Palestinian state is only a means for continuing our struggle against the State of Israel. So what if Palestinian nationalism is a recent phenomenon, asked the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger in an editorial. Iraq and Jordan were created in the last century out of the ruins of the Ottoman Empire. Would Gingrich also insult those nations by suggesting their relatively recent births mean their drives for statehood are somehow less legitimate? His reckless comments can only serve to further damage America's standing in the Arab world and its ability to act as a peace negotiator in the Middle East. But the Republican frontrunner doesn't care about tarnishing America's reputation, said Jacob Heilbrunn in nationalinterest.org. He cares only about winning the votes of pro-Israel evangelicals. A true friend of Israel wouldn't create more tension in a region that's already a powder keg. Gingrich is actually half right, said Michael Kinsley in the Los Angeles Times, but it doesn't matter. History has repeatedly shown that when a people come together to create a nationalistic identity, the world accepts their self-definition and their desire for self-rule. Just ask the Israelis. Modern Jewish nationalism only goes back to 1896, when the Hungarian-born journalist Theodor Herzl published his book, The Jewish State. 52 years later, Israel was created. If Palestinian nationalism was indeed born in 1967, the idea will mark its 52nd anniversary in 2019. The countdown to Palestinian nationhood is ticking. The second item from the talking point section is gay rights, the U.S.'s new foreign policy goal. Should the U.S. promote gay rights around the world? Asked Sandip Roy in HuffingtonPost.com. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton last week announced that the Obama administration would henceforth make it a foreign policy priority to promote tolerance for gays and lesbians, whom she described as an invisible minority in many countries, subject to being arrested, beaten, terrorized, even executed. Clinton said that the administration's efforts would include million-dollar grants for foreign gay rights groups, offers of asylum for refugees, and an active policy of putting diplomatic pressure on nations that criminalize homosexual conduct. Some 76 countries now enforce laws against same-gender sex, with punishments including prison, flogging, and death. Some Arab and African leaders may not like that this message is coming from the West, Clinton conceded, but as she pointed out, being gay is not a Western invention. It is a human reality. The Americans ought to practice what they preach, said Gitau Warigi in the Nairobi, Kenya Daily Nation. Perhaps Secretary Clinton should have saved her lecture for the 44 states that have refused to legalize same-sex marriage, or for the rabidly anti-gay evangelical wing of the Republican Party. In Africa, the majority of citizens do not want to see homosexuality normalized, which is why we have laws banning homosexual behavior. America can preach to us all it likes, but Africa's response is stuff it. As well it should be, said Robert Knight in the Washington Times. Sexual behavior has moral implications, and U.S. foreign aid should be used to promote our national security, not to force a radical agenda on the rest of the world. Forcing a gay rights agenda clearly won't work, especially in places like Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Uganda, said the Seattle Times in an editorial. But in the face of abuse and torture, America cannot, should not, look the other way. All Americans should take pride that our nation stands with persecuted gay men and women. Hillary got it right, said the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger. As she pointed out, basic human rights are not conferred by government, but belong to each of us by birthright. Just as the U.S. opposes racial apartheid, religious discrimination, and the brutal subjugation oppression of women in other lands, we must now stand with gay men and women everywhere. Gay rights are human rights. It's as simple as that. And the next item from Talking Points, Tebow, how faith leads to victory. Tim Tebow may be a miracle worker, said Andrew Sullivan in the DailyBeast.com, but he's not a very good Christian. The devoutly religious Denver Broncos quarterback with the ugly throwing motion has become a national sensation by leading his team to 6 wins in the last 7 games, all through jaw-dropping act of God comebacks in the final minutes. Tebow, however, has become a divisive figure in the nation's culture wars by flaunting his faith at every opportunity, thanking Jesus in every interview, pointing to heaven after every touchdown, and spending so much time in prayer on the sideline in his signature prayer pose, bowing his head, kneeling on one knee. Sorry, but this is not how Jesus instructed followers to act. In the Bible, Jesus says that believers should be careful not to do your acts of righteousness before men. Those who pray in public view, he warns, will have no reward from your Father in heaven. So why do Christians regard Tebow as a hero? Tebow's an evangelical, said Patton Dodd in the Wall Street Journal, and evangelicals follow Jesus' other instruction that you shouldn't hide your light under a bushel. Furthermore, Tebow backs up his piety with actions. Off the field, he spends his free time building hospitals, fundraising for orphanages, and working with the poor. Somehow, being such a straight arrow has become controversial, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. What a sad indictment of our cynical culture that a player who embodies everything meant by the cliche role model is for his critics a figure of fun or even hatred. I wish Tebow would tone down that God stuff, said Daniel Ingber in Slate.com, because it's making me question my atheism. Tebow is a mediocre quarterback playing for a lousy Broncos team that had a 1-4 record before he took over its huddle. What has happened since then defies all rational explanation. You need not share Tebow's faith to see that it's a big part of his success, said Frank Bruni in the New York Times. In dire situations that would discourage most other players, Tebow has a quiet, unshakable confidence that everything will work out for the best. His teammates are inspired by this, and more often than not, it does work out. Optimism matters a lot. That's a lesson all of us can learn from Tim Tebow's weekly miracles. And now let's take a look at our poll watch for this week. 39% of Americans say the United States should deport some illegal immigrants, but allow those who've been here for many years to stay if they haven't broken other laws. 28% say all illegal immigrants should be allowed to stay, but only if they break no other laws and commit to learning English and U.S. history. And 25% say all illegal immigrants should be deported. Well, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.